What would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, The Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology now streaming only on Prime Video. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s, with the city on the edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iorinde returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Don Reeve, who's been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detectives shaken, to find the Southside Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, The Scare features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, The Scare on Prime Video, now streaming.
This is the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
You're really into this, aren't you?
Boils and ghouls, lock your doors and strap yourselves in. From Los Angeles, California, Bloody Disgusting presents the Boo Crew Podcast. Horror news, commentary, reviews, interviews, and more. With your hosts, Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio.
Hi, it's Trevor, and on behalf of myself, Lauren and Leo, welcome home to your Boo Crew. At time of release, if you're going to be in the LA area this weekend, December 2nd through 4th, we're going to be hanging out at Season Screamings. It's a holiday horror convention at the Pasadena Convention Center. It's got vendors, special guests, and more. We're going to be hosting a very cool panel on Sunday with writer-director Mike Flanagan, actors Kate Siegel, Alex Esso, Henry Thomas, and Annabeth Gish for the Flaniverse reunion. It's going to be a great time. We're going to be talking about everything from Midnight Mass to The Brilliant Haunting of Hill House, Dr. Sleep, Midnight Club, and a little bit of what's to come with future projects like Fall of the House of Usher. Come on by, ask some questions, say hey. Tickets available at midsummerscream.org. On to episode 364 in a conversation with renegade filmmaker and indie cinema icon, Jeff Lieberman. We explore the myth, mystery, and fun behind his incredible 2004 fright flick, one of our faves, Satan's Little Helper. On the heels of its exclusive and beautiful looking Scream Box release and a brand new Blu-ray packed with special features, go behind the mask with us on this cult classic. Relive insane key shots, the many unforgettable improvised moments, set pieces, find out who's underneath all that latex and how it all came together. We also revisit Jeff's 1976 masterpiece, Squirm, and working with FX genius Rick Baker. Projects with Rod Serling and his extraordinary new book, Day of the Living Me, Adventures of a Subversive Cult Filmmaker from the Golden Age, available everywhere now. All right, episode 364 with Jeff Lieberman and Satan's Little Helper is now slaying.
Go ahead, scream. That's all we need.
Another victim crawls onto the gurney for a Boo Crew autopsy.
All right, here we go. Joining Bloody Disgusting's Boo Crew via the Speakeasy Studios, a phenomenal filmmaker whose work is so singular and inventive that every one of his projects becomes a classic. From attending the School of Visual Arts in New York City, he went on to co-write his first feature alongside the Oscar-winning Ernest Pintoff with Blade in 1973. Then he wrote and directed what became one of the genre films that defined an era, with the beloved creature feature Squirm in 76 and Blue Sunshine that inspired legions of fans such as Joe Dante, The Cure's Robert Smith, and Steve Severin from Susie and the Banshees, among the many. He followed it up with Dr. Franken and more absolute essential viewing, 81's Backwoods Slasher Just Before Dawn in 1988's absolutely awesome Remote Control with Kevin Dillon and Jennifer Tilly. Before dreaming up a delightful court TV show featuring the iconic John Waters, he crafted yet another incredible piece of work, and it is on the top of our Halloween must-watch list every year. It's become synonymous with the holiday itself for many. It's called Satan's Little Helper. It is now streaming exclusively on Screambox. It's now available on Synapse Films on Blu-ray, uncut for the first time ever, with a bevy of special features that we cannot wait to tear into. The film follows a 9-year-old boy whose obsession with a bizarre and violent satanic video game comes to life one Halloween. What transpires is unsettling, hilarious, and terrifying, as is always the wonderful journey one gets at the hands of the brilliant Emmy-winning writer-director Jeff Lieberman, who we welcome to the show. Jeff, thank you so much for being here, my man.
Can you say all that again? I missed that. It's like, I feel like, you know, Sally Fields, you know, at the Academy Awards.
It is an honor, man, and thank you again so much for the time to take to speak with us. And, man, on behalf of horror fans everywhere, thank you for continuing to fuel our imaginations with your astonishing creativity and unique voice, my man. It is appreciated so much, I can't tell you.
I appreciate being appreciated, and I didn't until... What is that? You're supposed to smell the roses? I was a late smeller. I'm a late smeller. I mean, really, I just like do and think, and I'm not thinking of like, who's going to watch this, go on to the next thing. You get to a certain point, I guess, because I did. And I just said, people are getting your autograph and people are, you know, taken in. You could croak at any minute, you know, and it's like it's a good thing, but it making it sound maudlin, but that's, you caught me at a good time.
Thank goodness for that. Because they say, you know, never meet your heroes. And man, you're projecting amazingness right now. This is great. So where do you think that your sense of style came from? What were the horror films and genre films that raised you?
Well, the most influential one, you know, was The Incredible Shrinking Man. And the reason, half the reason, was that I was 10. When you see a movie that has an impact on you and you're 10, it's, you know, I know that would squirm. I, you know, when I see Guillermo del Toro, Eli Roth, all these guys, and they come up to me, they squirm and so much, then I go, how old were you? You know, and Blue Sunshine, Eli would say, you know, me and my brother, we sat on, we're not supposed to watch it. Our parents were watching on TV and we sat on the stairs. I said, that's half of it. That it was so influential at the time you saw it. Now, but in my case, I'm not comparing myself to Steven Spielberg, except you always hear about guys like him with 8mm film camera, and they were making movies when they were 12. I had no interest in film, none. And I didn't even like to go to movies. I had a really good rational reason. That really shows my personality. When I started dating girls, to me, the stupidest thing to do was to take them to a movie. You pick them up, the father goes, now he's going to be back at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock. You got an 8 o'clock show. You're going to sit in a dark theater looking at the screen for 2 hours. And then you got like, oh, shit, you know, if there's traffic, I'm not going to get home. It's stupid. If it was a drive-in, whole other story.
Sure.
But most of the time, it wasn't a drive-in. So, you know, I had no interest in film at all. Hollywood, like, to me, Rock Hudson was Hollywood. And every, you know, that kind of Hollywood movies, no interest until I saw Blow Up.
Really?
That rocked my world. So if it wasn't for Antonioni, I'd be a doctor like my brother, probably.
Wow. So that was a film that got you just down the path completely and made you just delve right into it all. Was that film?
Yeah, because I thought of movies like Ben-Hur. You know, I never thought of it as an art film. No, nobody used the term cinema. That was like came later. Nobody. It was I had to be exposed to it. And I went to School of Visual Arts and I was exposed to it somewhat. But when I worked at Janus Films, we had all the Italian and French and Truffaut, and we had all the Bergman movies, the early Hitchcock movies, and I really got steeped in cinema, not film, cinema. And I got into that kind of, so I saw it in a whole different way. Why I wound up doing Squirm is I took that cinema idea and I had a traumatic experience when I was around 10. My brother, we used to go fishing, and worms are expensive. So he read in Popular Mechanics that you can get them out of the ground if you shock them. And you use your train transformer, you take a pole, metal pole, and stick it into the mud. You have to wet the ground down. And we had a swimming pool, the kind of swimming pools that you take down in the winter. So it leaves a big mud round circle. And it was perfect. We stuck that thing in, and we had a light for the pool. So we did this in the dark. And then he says, "You ready?" And I had a little bucket to get the worms. And he zaps it with the Lionel train transformer. And then he says, "Turn the light on." I turn the light on, and all these worms are coming out of the ground, like hundreds. I don't know. In my mind, well, it was hundreds of them. And then we had to go pick them up before. And then they hit the light and then went back in. Right? So now, 7 years, about 9 years after that, I took LSD, you take that experience, add LSD, and you got squirm. It's that simple. Boys and girls.
Now, I want to say, on Squirm, is it true that it was like Rick Baker's first attempt at practical effects was with Squirm, right?
Not so. Well, he was Dick Smith's assistant, protege, whatever you want to call it. So it might have been his first. Full credit, I really don't know, but it was his first attempt at using prosthetics. And I didn't know what he was talking about until I saw it. And I said, "We got one." Rick said, "You're going to pull these worms up with monofilament line through these channels in each." The reason that prosthetics are they became the standard is you're wearing a mask. It looks like a mask because you have no expression. The face is kind of fixed. But if you have prosthetics, you can move a cheek up and make it, you look at the eyes. But they're so thin and flimsy, they're not designed to have rubber worms pulled through them with monofilament line. And he said, on the budget we had, he said, "You get to do it." He couldn't test it. We didn't have the money to test it. And he made it from a mold from the actor we cast. And then the testing of it was... roll the cameras. We had one shot at it, and it looked great.
Yeah, it looks fantastic. That's amazing.
It looked great when we did it. You didn't even have to see the dailies. I remember saying, if this doesn't get lost in the lab, we had people on the crew. We had this one guy named Mongo. He was like 300 pounds, big, tall guy. And somebody says, "Where's Mongo?" "Oh, he's over. He's in the swamp throwing up from that scene."
What?
And I said, "How
could
he?" He saw exactly how we're doing it, and he still reacted that way. So I said, "Yeah, if this doesn't work, I don't know anything."
Right? That's it. There's no better sign than that. Wow.
I'm going puke. That should have been the.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So talk a bit about the kind of the gap in between, I guess, remote control and getting Satan's Little Helper off the ground. What were you working on in the middle of that period? And just kind of talk about getting Satan's Little Helper off the ground.
Between remote control and Satan's Little Helper, this is the funny thing about the biz, is that I did more than the rest of my career times three and made 10 times the money that I made on the five movies. But like, for instance, I did a thing called But Seriously, a Showtime. It was a very high budget. Rob Reiner was executive producer. It was totally mainstream. Castle Rock. Richard Crystal was my partner. It was a history of, it was a political a comedy thing. It was starting in 1960. And you see what the news said and you see what the comics said at the time. And I went back and forth up till 93 when I made it, and we had everybody in it, and it got unbelievable reviews, and they asked us to do another, but you don't know that. And I produced it and directed it. Sonny Liston for HBO won three. I directed it, and it was won three Emmy Awards. But if you're in the world of, it's like I'm in a coma. Somebody actually said I was dead during that time.
Are you kidding me? Oh my God.
He died of, well, you know how you could believe everything on the internet. So it said, the guy said, oh yeah, yeah, he died of like specific cancer. So I'm thinking, well, not a brain tumor, not, but cancer, not a car accident. Very specific. The guy knew. Well, it's such a shame. And, but during that period of time, I was writing, I wrote a script for Dustin Hoffman. I wrote a script, Bob Chartoff, who did, Chartoff Winkler did, you know, all the Rocky movies. And I was in like the, it was Billy Crystal says, he clawed his way to the middle, you know, Mr. Saturday. And I was in, I wasn't the hottest, I was in the middle. I mean, I was making Hollywood money during that time, living in Beverly Hills, and nobody that I work with, and I told my agent, they never mentioned my sordid past of making genre movies. Because like Murray Siskel, who wrote Tootsie, he said to me, why don't you show Dustin Squirm? I said, what for? I'm writing a script with Dustin Hoffman. I mean, he pitched it to him. And he said, well, maybe Dustin wants you to direct. And I said, I'm not going to show him, you know, like Squirm? Like, no, it's got nothing to do with what we're doing. Like, I talked my way out of what could have been, you know, a huge, and that's what I do. But anyway, yeah, so during that period of time, I, you know, the Neverending Story 3, I never even heard of the Neverending Story at all. And because of the Dustin Hoffman thing, I got a gig on a, that time, at that time, $35 million movie, which today's money would, you know, so you can imagine the paycheck. I was the only writer. Jack Black was in it, and you know, it had the Creatures.
Yeah, and, Jim Henson working on it, and
yeah, Jim Henson Creatures, and like so, I had fun. But again, from the point of view of people that are into the genre, exploded later on. I never thought any of this would happen. I got a call from Mike Gingold in Beverly Hills saying, "Hi, I'm Mike Gingold from Fangoria Magazine." I went, "What?" Fangoria, it sounds like he just made that up. It's one of my friends. What do you? And he said, we want to interview you, you know, for the magazine. And then I said, oh, there really is a Fangoria. And I went to one of these conventions, and all of a sudden, I have an entourage of fans. It was like the weirdest thing because it wasn't my existence at that time. It was like something I did when I was younger, you know? And so here I is.
Oh, my God. So during that time, is it through those times and, you know, being kind of reinstilled back in the genre community that the wheels started turning on Satan's Little Helper? Or was it an idea before that?
Neither. You pinned it. Bingo. Neither. What it was is that I turned the big 5-0. I figured I'm going to have a... you know, because my birthday is October 16th. Thank you. So I said, I preempted your thing. So I said, I'm going to have a Halloween party and all my friends are, you know, they have some money and they can go out and spend money on costumes. I said, you can't come without a costume. So everybody showed up. I had a big house, which I don't have now in Westchester. And they all, everybody showed up in unbelievable costumes and was smoking weed and we're drinking, we're like complete party mode. And I figured, okay, you know, it's an hour late, everybody's here. And suddenly a gorilla comes in. Full gorilla outfit, you know, you don't know who's in. And he's going around, he's acting like a gorilla, jumping on the furniture and acting like an asshole, like people with a gorilla outfit. And I figured, oh, I know who that is. It's the only guy I know would do that. And he starts dancing with me and we're dancing around and I see, shit, the guy I think is in the gorilla outfit is standing over there with his wife.
Oh,
so who the fuck is this? It went, went from having fun to, this could be like in the newspaper tomorrow. Guy comes in, knows there's a Halloween party. Anybody could come in costume and you're not, you know, I don't have a guy at the door checking IDs or anything. And so half my brain was trying to get my, she was in the kitchen, my wife with the caterer, and I try to get her attention because this could be like a 911 thing. And the other half of my brain, I don't know which one, said, there's a movie here. There's a movie here because this is real. Like you say, that could never happen. This is fucking happening right now. It turned out that it was a gorillagram from, you know, remember Charles Rocket? Yeah. So Charlie in LA, who's a longtime friend of mine, and he and his wife, they didn't pay attention. They couldn't come from LA, couldn't make it. So they sent me a gorillagram. Now, if it was a Tuesday night, you know, without Halloween, I would, as soon as I'd see a gorilla come to my door, I go, ah, it's a gorillagram, right? But on Halloween party, he didn't do it intentionally, but if it wasn't for Charlie, I never would have gotten the idea. But, you know, it's just one of those things.
Yeah, completely out of context. It's terrifying.
That's what happened.
Wow.
I mean, because if you have somebody in an in-depth story, you know, they think it's the boyfriend. It's really the serial killer in this outfit. Same thing.
Wow. One of the things that I love about the way this is written, too, are those, like, freaking jarring moments that you stick in the script. Like some of them are really nuanced, like Dougie's like madly in love with his sister, right? He talks about marrying his sister, or you'll just linger the camera on the Satan character sniffing all the family's underwear in the laundry room.
It's crazy. You know, that was, you know, we were in the laundry room in the house. It's, you know, a lot of the stuff I do that winds up being the kind of highlight stuff is not in the script, even though I wrote the script. I do that all the time. I'm always kind of improvising on the moment when you're actually there to shoot. And we were in somebody's laundry room. And, you know, the camera's here and all. I just said to the guy, pick up, because it was the woman in the house. We didn't prop that basket.
Was just her stuff.
And so everybody in the kitchen upstairs was looking at the monitors, you know, waiting for us to do this, the actual scene. And I said, I forgot the guy's name already because we had other people, but I said, pick up the underwear and sniff the underwear. And I heard him laughing under the mask. And I heard them up. I said, roll the camera. That's all you have to do. And they saw it. And I heard them laughing up in the kitchen. And then the women said, you're not going to actually use that, are you? I went, bingo, you just gave it like 100 on the scale by asking that question.
Right.
Totally.
Right.
Yeah. The thing with the cat?
Yes, my favorite scene.
Not in the script.
How is that not in the script?
Wow.
How is that not?
It was not in the script because what happened
did
was,
you just grab a real cat and destroy it?
We only had to kill one cat because we got 9. but the thing is, we're there, and I'm going like, okay, what's the next? Joe Mangine, who is the director of photography on Squirm, and he had so much experience over me. He kept saying to me, "What's the next thing you're going to see on the screen?" Because when you're shooting low budget, and you want to put like John Waters says, you know, make a dollar holler. You really have to know what not to shoot. Not so much, you know, what the shoot is obvious, but don't shoot stuff that's not going to wind up in the movie. So what's the next image on the screen? I always fought him on that. And then I realized that's brilliant if you can do it. And I said, well, the next thing after this scene is Catherine Winnick seeing her boyfriend come home. And we, the audience, know it's not her boyfriend. It's this maniac, right? Well, what have you seen him do thus far? You saw him drag a guy, you know, you saw after the fact kills. You never saw him kill anybody. You saw him pull out a dead body down the stairs and put a flower on. You saw him propping up people on a thing, but you never saw him. You knew he did it, but you never saw him do it. And he beats up the boyfriend, you know, like a beats the shit out of him, but he doesn't even cut him up. So I'm thinking, what's the sickest? I want the sick factor is not there yet. I just knew it intuitively. It's like he's violent and he can kill her, but I want to go for sick, and sick is different, right? So then I thought, I just came. I said, get me a cat. A cat. I said, get me a black cat, and it has to have bells on the collar. Don't ask. We don't have the time. Just do it. And so what they did was, I should have said any fucking cat. They went out and got a trained $5,000 for a trained cat. I don't know what a trained cat does. You know, with a trainer, she came down with the whole, all I need is him take meow, the little cat and pick him up. And then I said, go to the toy store and get a black cat stuffed animal. And then we'll take the stuffing out and put a prosthetic, you know, blood thing. And then it's two shots. And so when we did it, because we had the monitor, because Suit and Digital, they're all in there. And even though, again, pick up the cat and on action, throws a real cat. Then the next angle is the cat, the fake cat, hitting that wall and writing boo with it. It was all at the moment I thought of it. They all scream. I got the scream. They say, it's not a real cat. I'm not. And if they scream, they're going to scream. Everybody sees the movie. And so when the movie premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival, that's not a horror audience. That's like a white wine snobby audience.
Yeah.
I didn't even want it to be there, but they wanted it so bad. And it was 400 people there. They were all so shocked. And the first thing they asked me in the Q&A was about the cat. So that's when I got that line. You know, it's like, you really think I'm going to take a real cat and do it? But it really did look realistic. So I did it. We only had to kill one cat. To me, it's an hour, like a split. But they go, it was silent. And they go, oh, I get it, you know. So you guys got it right away.
Oh, my God. What did they think about, like, mowing down blind people and pregnant lady and babies? That audience.
What's not to love?
Right. Right.
I mean, come on, Jack. You really swear on the Bible that you never, when you stop at a light and you see a nun or you see a blood, you didn't say how many points. Come on. I mean, be honest. Everybody on the planet Earth, in every culture in the world, they don't actually carry it out. You go, if I hit those three kids, ricochet, or how many points do I get? I mean, I did that when I was a kid. So it's a natural.
We love the way your brain works because it's amazing. Yeah. Leo, you had a question about Dougie, man. Hit him.
Yeah, the young lead character of Dougie, played by Alexander Brickle, has this absolute innocence on the concept of Satan and murder and death. Was his character inspired by someone you knew, or perhaps your young thoughts on Satan and Halloween and costumes?
No. What it was is I wrote it for a younger kid. At a certain age, a kid would buy all of that. You know, it would work for a younger kid. But I also knew, when I brought up Steven Spielberg, if you have the Spielberg money, meaning, you know, when you work with a kid, a really young kid that can't remember lines and all, you're going to have three times, and the kid's the main character, you have to have three times the time to work with them. And I knew from, because I've made other movies, there's no way. And this kid is really IQ-wise, he's a brilliant kid, and he was able to memorize all the lines, and then I could work with him to make it come from him. But you can't do that with a little kid that they're not going to remember. You're going to have to go sentence by sentence, and it's like working with an animal. They always say kids and animals. So I made that compromise. And I knew that if I had that movie to do, if you gave me enough money and I did that movie today, I might even consider, now here's with it, non-PC, doing with a Down syndrome kid, right? Because then it would be, okay, it would be very controversial and everything, but you'd buy everything, right? Because he had, I was trying to make a statement, you know, which I was, you know, maybe it's too heavy handed because, you know, video games, you say, well, video games, what impact do they have on kids? But my biggest statement that's in the film that pissed off all of South America is about religion, because I'm basically saying, and I believe, what's the difference between the kids saying, who can win in a fight, Batman or Spider-Man? You heard that all the time when I was a kid, Superman against Batman. Well, when I said, well, who can win in a fight, Spider-Man or Jesus? What's the difference? From a kid's point of view, Jesus is not a superhero. I was trying, and oh, Satan. Well, who? Well, Satan could beat up Spider-Man. Well, Spider-Man would put Satan in it. And well, Jesus would call God, and, you know, it's all bullshit. There's no difference. The Bible is like, they said it was, I would believe it if it was Marvel. Just put the Marvel stamp on it, and it worked. It totally works. It's a little slow. It's a little slow. You know, but, so that's where I was coming from, but I was trying to, because I had, you know, sometimes creative freedom, you need a, I didn't have anybody say, Jeff, you're trying to say too much in this story. And I really was. That's all I was thinking about. Because I know I have my filmmaking chops from making four movies before it. So that's what I was trying to get across. That was the thing. And evidently, all of South America wouldn't touch the movie because the Catholic, you know, this guy shows up as, you know, Jesus. And then the girls say Jesus is Satan, even though it's in context of the story. Forget it. You can't say Jesus is Satan and sell in South America. That's a lot of
yeah,
money.
Yeah. What about there is all those undertones too about like the absence of a father figure. It's in Alex's backstory. It's a bit in Dougie's backstory. We see his dad's at work, like basically the whole movie. Was that what was going through your head in terms of that?
Yeah, well, so it was not so much, you know, Dougie's father was just work. He comes back with a briefcase. That's normal. But I wanted to humanize. There's a scene in the costume store.
Yeah.
Where Alex, wait, who's who? Yeah, Alex is a character. The character. He when he says, that's not Satan. He goes, well, it is to me. See, because Amanda Plummer, if you listen to the dialogue at the beginning of the movie, she lays out the whole thing. She says that there's evil, and it's not necessarily a guy with a pitchfork and, you know, but there is evil everywhere in the world, and the kid's disappointed because it's too ethereal. It's too, you know, you can't visualize it. And she says, unless he's wearing a costume, like his little helper. So that plants in the kid, I look for somebody in a costume. But to Alex, his father is Satan. See, so again, I was like, all these ideas. On the 15th watch, you will get all this stuff.
I think I made it through about 15 watches at this point, I think.
No, you know, people watch this on Halloween like it's, here's my wish. Don't make another dime on the movie ever, but it becomes the Christmas Story rotation, like, you know, like 24-hour marathon. That, to me, would be on Halloween, like Halloween TNT, 24-hour thing. I would just, you know, because there's people, when I go to conventions, they memorize. There's people that memorize Squirm. Not saw it a million times, but memorized every line of Squirm. And they stand in front of me. Guy did it just last month at Cinema Wasteland. And I said, come on, you can't. Are you crazy? And he did it. I recorded him. And I gave him a scene that no way he, you know, it's not like you're going to be the worm face. And he nailed. I couldn't do it. And I wrote it. Everywhere. So I want that for this movie.
Oh, man. Well, it's happening, man. It's happening with all these releases and everything. What do you think? Well, how does that make you feel that people are still, you know, some 20 years after Satan's Little Helper was completed, are gravitating toward it and discovering it, new fans every day.
It's kind of like what happened to all the other movies of mine. I mean, Blue Sunshine is huge around the world. I go to, there's film festivals everywhere, and I go I was in March, I was in Brussels, and the same, I was in Finland, thinking, okay, there's no way anybody in Finland knows me. And I went to, a film thing, and I'm guest of honor, and the line went out up the stairs and down the block to get my autograph. In Finland, I can't find Finland on the map. So
Finland found you.
It's mind-boggling to me, and I'm not going to say humbling, because all these douchebags use that word all the time, but it's the H word. Seriously, it's like I never, I always say better late than never. All the other stuff that I did is not famous. Like if you ask me what's the best thing I ever did, it's probably But Seriously, the thing that was on Showtime. In other words, what I set out to do and what didn't get lost in the translation was, it was great because we had the money. We had a lot of money. But who cares, right? When you see a documentary on TV, do you look, well, who directed it? Is that the same guy? No. So at least I'm known for something.
The Boo Crew will be right back.
What would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, The Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology now streaming only on Prime Video. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s, with the city on the edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iorinde returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Don Reeve, who's been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detectives shaken, to find the Southside Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, The Scare features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, The Scare on Prime Video, now streaming.
You sweat, but you don't dare move. You want to scream, but you can't. Terror grips every nerve in your body. And your heart is beating so fast, it feels like your eardrums are going to burst. You swallow hard, and you realize there is nothing you can do but wait and squirm. Now American International Pictures presents Squirm, the ultimate horror. Millions of writhing, seething creatures oozing out of the mire, shocked into a frenzy by 100,000 volts of electricity, driven by an uncontrollable urge to feed on human flesh. Squirm. Rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent.
Let's talk about the rest of the cast, just getting Amanda Plummer involved and how she took to everything. I mean, she was incredible.
When we were looking for that role, the producer, Eisen Robbins, said to me, Amanda Plummer really wants to do this. And I'm thinking, because I already had Catherine Winnick, I'm trying to think in my head, although I know she's a really good actress, but how could she be her mother? In Hollywood, they never pay attention to that shit. Well, we'll dye her hair blonde, And it didn't work for me, but she was politicking to get the role. It wasn't me trying to get her. And I don't remember. She didn't have to read for it because I knew who she was. It's just a question, do I want to do that? And it turned out, I'm thinking, how does she even know who I am that she wants to do this? And she was living with Toby Hooper for like a long time. They were like a couple. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, but we obviously, I knew who he was. He knew who I was. And he probably said, you got to work with Jeff Lieberman because there's no other. I never even asked her about it, but I'm sure because we did talk about Toby, when I got to know her, and that's probably what happened. But she was real. She wanted to do it. So then, and working with her, I mean, she's brilliant, but you have to know if it was my first film, forget it. She would have walked off. I mean, when I was doing Squirm, she'd be so over my head the way she worked. I wouldn't have any idea, and she would know it. You know, like they say, when you get on a horse, the horse knows if you can ride or not.
Sure, yes, yeah.
She is that person, and with her experience, and because it was my fifth film, I got it, and I got to work at the top of my game to get the best performance out of her, and I think I did. I mean, it was great. I mean, we're friends today. We're like, you know, we had a great experience. So, and then Catherine Winnick.
Yeah, Catherine, she's huge Winnick, now. Huge after Satan's Little Helper.
But listen to this. I had a magic touch. When I did that movie, my history in the other four movies, when I turned down the finalists to the roles, they all became huge stars. Turned down. When I cast them, none of them became a big star.
Interesting.
I had Squirm, I had Martin Sheen, I had Kim Basinger, and I had Sylvester Stallone. That could have been all I had to do was say, cast them, scale, same money.
Because they were all not decided to be in it.
I decided.
You decided. What?
Brilliant. And, you know, it's easy to have 20/20 hindsight, but I'm not saying, you know, Donnie Scardino did a great job and Pat, they all were great, but they didn't, you know, Donnie became a very big TV director.
Sure.
But as far as actors, that's what I did. Blue Sunshine, I cast Zalman King. So then I got to get the doctor. So I'm casting with the doctor and this guy, Jeff Goldblum, comes in. It's like
this guy, Jeff Goldman,
1977, and he's like tall and he's got a big honker and Zalman. So the two of them are sitting at the table reading the scene, you know, because Zalman's already cast. And I said, this is going to be on the screen, two like Jewish anteaters. That's the image that I had in my head. And I can't do this to the audience. He was to play a surgeon. His father's a surgeon. It's like he knows this shit. And I went, eh. And so I got Robert Walden, who was great. I mean, it's not like I'm saying the people that I cast, Robert Walden, you know, he was in Lou Grant and after that. And I'm not belittling the performances because I always got good actors, but I suck at smelling who's going to be a superstar. I don't know. Maybe I should. Agents know that, or managers. But and then let's see, who else did I fuck up? Here's a good one.
Okay.
Remote Control.
Yeah, so okay, Remote Control.
I get Kevin Dillon. He had done Platoon. I saw him Platoon. I said, this is a guy, he's real crude kind of, you know, guy, and he was Matt Dillon's brother. Back then it was like Jennifer Tilly, it was Meg Tilly's sister. Right. So there's a name on the box. That's what they used to call that kind of casting. You're not going to get Meg Tilly. You're not going to get Matt Dillon. So you get his brother and his sister. So Kevin, who's still in, he had a crew cut. He was still in the Oliver Stone mentality of Platoon. He goes, you got to meet my buddy. I'm not going to tip it off. You got to meet my buddy from Platoon. You know, to play the other guy in the video store. I said, Kevin, this is not Platoon history. You know, I'm casting the thing. come on, you're just going to meet him, you know? I told him, you know, that you would say, okay, you know, okay. So I told the kid's friend, I got to meet his brother, his friend. So his friend comes in, and he had a crew touch too, because it was right after that thing. And he was boring as shit. Boring. Then we still have video cassettes. We were recording the casting session, and I'm have a pile of cassettes in my place in BH, and I'm going through all the casting, and my teenage daughter walks by behind me, and she says, "Oh my God, who's that?" I said, "It's Kevin's friend." And she goes, "Oh my God, he's gorgeous." I said, "He is? Like, really?" And Johnny Depp. All I had to do was say, okay, you guys. I'm brilliant at spotting, like, not casting people that are going to be super. And you know what these movies would be worth if I actually cast the people that I could have had just by saying yes.
Yeah.
But I had to. So when Catherine came in, I said to her, you know, because she's like a kind of a finalist, and I said, I got to tell you something. If I cast you, you're either never going to work again, or you know, you're going to go right into oblivion, you know. And she left. She goes, no, you know, you're superstar. I said, no, look at my track record. I told her my track record. It's like impeccable. I suck at this. It's superstar. You could be great in the movie, but, you know, you can wind up being a waitress. And so when I saw, I'm driving down Sunset Boulevard and I see her on a giant billboard for Vikings. And I lost, like the curse is gone.
Yeah.
I lost my
Or the gift, man. Either way, right?
Yeah. I don't know. But I mean, it's unbelievable how every one of those movies could have had. I mean, Stallone, he was working as a waiter. He just wanted to read. And I said, and I already knew, I saw the Lords of Flapper. So I already knew who he was and I already liked him. But I said, that guy down in the South in a worm farm? I mean, if you think about it, I was right. From casting, he would have sucked, but he still survived. And Kim Basinger, here's my brilliant thing. She comes in, she's 21 years old, Ford Model Agency. If you think that she was beautiful in the movies, when she came out of the Ford Model Agency to act, we were sitting there, me and the two producers, we didn't talk, couldn't talk. That's how gorgeous she was. And I said, we're shooting in Georgia. Oh, I'm from Georgia. And she had a little, really? Oh, and I'm kind of like, this nudity, you know, shower scene. She goes, I have no problem with my body. It's like, whoa. And so when she left, they said, well, what do you think? And I said, who's going to believe that she lives next door to a worm farm? It's not believable. It's like Little Abner, right? That's logical. But these were Broadway producers, Edgar Lansbury and Joe Beru. That's Angela's brother. They are classy, the auteur. You know, they actually listened to me on my first movie instead of saying Sam Arcroft. If he was there, he would have grabbed me, thrown me up against the wall and say, what's the name of this fucking movie? Squirm? What's it about? Worms electrified? Who's going to see this picture? Horny teenage guys, you know? Yeah. That's what they want to see in the shower. I'm pissing, you idiot. I learned the hard way.
So who auditioned for Satan's Little Helper? Like Brad Pitt? George Clooney?
Yeah, I know. That's my, I know.
Talking about Satan himself, so is it one actor under that outfit? Or is there a couple of different people under that?
No, like five.
Really?
When I realized I didn't know, I likened it to like George Romero, who I really didn't know. I met him a couple of times, but how do you tell they weren't even called zombies, 9/11 dead? Like, you came out of the dead. How do you direct somebody? And if you watch, I mean, I watched 9/11 Dead. I think it's the stupidest thing. Their arms, you go, flail your arms. You know, like, how are you supposed to act when you were dead and now you're not dead or whatever it is? And they're all going, and to me, it was just stupid. But, so I couldn't. So how does this guy, this weird, twisted guy, the way I wrote it, but how is he going to behave when he can't talk? And so we literally discovered the character right down the sidewalk the first time I shot him with a little kid, where, him going, we came up with that stuff.
Yeah, putting the thumbs up and kind of exaggerated.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And all that reaction, we kind of formed the personality as we did it. And then we knew what he's going to do. And once he got it, the situation, I didn't really have to tell him what to do because he knew what this guy would do. But what with a stunt person, you put him in the costume, you don't know you're looking at a stunt person, but they can know, then I could tell them this is what the guy would do because I knew who the guy was. So it got to a point where we're shooting on Long Island in the fall. We shot the whole movie, the main movie, in July. We made it look like the fall and Halloween. And then we shot the graveyard, a lot of scenes in the fall, and he wasn't available, the guy that you saw. So I said, I told my AD who was there, Neil Daly, he was there all the time, smart guy. I said, guess what? You're it. So that was, when the old woman with the walker.
Yeah, with the candy falling all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was just standing behind the camera, and Neil was in the outfit, and I said, look at your watch, you're sleeping, it just takes a long time. That was my AD.
Oh, that's amazing.
So it was probably five different people that played, but the main character, the main guy was that guy, whose name I don't remember.
Did you, the mask and everything, was that all bespoke? Was that made just for the movie, or did you pick it out from somewhere?
When I'm writing the script, I said I have to have an image of what this character that I'm creating is going to look like. And so I went on the internet and I just looked up masks and I, thousands of masks. And then I come across it. I go, that's the guy. So I printed out a picture of it and I taped it to my wall next to my computer. So while I was typing, I would look up at that face and know what to write. But I didn't have the mask. So then when the movie came together, I told the production people, I got to have a mask. And they came up with, how easy it is, devil mask. No. I got to have that mask, that one mask. And they, and the guy said, "Oh, I'm sorry, they broke the mold." It's like that expression.
Oh, it's like it was like an old mask that they didn't make anymore.
Yeah. And I said, "Don't tell the, don't make it like we need a mask to be the centerpiece of a movie called Satan's Little Helper. This is Satan. Tell them we need a mask for a movie."
Right. Exactly. Smart.
$300. Yeah. Wow. I was one of the producers. So they did. And it was $320. And we got a backup one that looked shitty for the real, we didn't want to ruin it. So we had a backup one for violent stuff where you're not going to get a good look at it. And I still have the mask.
Oh, wow. So there's two masks total used in the whole production of the film.
Yeah. Well, the one main mask, it's thick. It's like, keeps on ticking. I have it in a bag right now because my daughter laid claim. I have two daughters, and one of them was on the set of Squirm when she was three.
Wow.
And somebody offered me years ago $10,000 for the clapper, the slate.
Yeah.
And she said, no, that's mine, my daughter. And she said, I was on, it means a lot to me. So, okay. And, because I'd give it a $10,000 anyway, it's like she's my daughter. So she has it in one of those shadow boxes.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. That's beautiful.
And then so my younger daughter, Emily, she wants the mask, which they're knocking off this mask. I mean, I did a screening, the Satan man and the little kid walking towards me. I thought, this is like the longest delayed acid kickback or whatever you call it, flashback ever, because they're there. And what happened was, this husband and wife loved the movie so much, they went and made the costumes, bought the mask on the internet, with they're selling them like crazy, claiming them from the movie they're not. But I'm not going to, you know, to me, it's advertising.
Sure,
know?
Of course.
And, and the woman was in the kid's mask. They came up to me and was like, oh, shit. And they drove up from like Philadelphia or something. And so, I hope it's a big phenomenon.
That is so cool. What about his hands? Did you have to have those made, or were they just, again, store-bought pieces?
Yeah, store-bought. There was nothing, because, as a matter of fact, when she said, where did you get that coat, the old lady? She said, did you steal it from a Hasid? Guess what? I said, the guy, you got to go down to East New York or someplace where this Hasidic guy in Brooklyn, where they actually sell this shit, right? And yeah, and I just said, don't tell them what you're using it for. Because, they sell that. The people that I said, here's the story. You say your uncle is in from Israel. I made up some whole bullshit story, because they wouldn't sell it if they said, oh, we're doing a movie called Satan's Little Helper. and Satan guys wear the fucking, right. That's not a say.
The worst thing ever.
And they came back and I said, I need like three of them, because they could rip it. You know, he's wearing it through the whole movie. So you need backups. So that was a cross my finger thing.
Yeah.
But it worked.
Oh my God. And what about the other mask? Like, does that Jesus mask actually, did they make a mask like that in Jesus?
I have that too. No, that was created. I don't know. Anthony Pepe, who's great, who also I hired for the John Waters thing. And Anthony did, it was like clear. You could see through the plastic, and it only became real when you put it on. You know what I mean? And so what happened was, we're shooting this whole movie and he's Satan. We get to, in the shoot, it just so happens later in the shoot, now we're going to see the Jesus character in the house. And I hadn't seen it. And I go up to makeup and I see them putting it on. I'm going, is this going to work? I go downstairs. I didn't know the wig and the thorns. And he comes down the stairs. And my AD, same guy, Neil Daly, he turned white. And a couple of other people on the set, the girls, like, there was silence. What's going on here? And then Neil said, I got to go out and get air. Like, he's getting dizzy. And I looked at him and I said, this looks great. What happened was, if you're a Catholic, like Neil said to me, I have no Jesus. Satan, the whole thing, nothing. But he didn't expect that to happen. Like Jesus, it was so scary to him. And my wife went to Catholic school all the way through till high school, and she doesn't give a shit. But certain people do. She didn't react that way, but she wasn't there. But people reacted more frightened by the Jesus image than Satan. And I'm like, whoa, this is so either above my pay grade or way below my, because they're both fictional. They're both Batman and Superman to me, anyway, superheroes. And so it was a real awakening.
There's some about that expressionless humanoid face that is, and the fact that it's Jesus face is terrifying. It really is. Yeah. It's a really
disturbing. Great job. I mean, it was the same guy. It was the same.
Wow.
I remember some of the theater, but yeah.
And then the video game element. Was it an actual playable video game, or is it just some animation somebody made?
No. What happened was, we had no money. The video game was, they call flat. It was done at the very last minute, like an afterthought. It was either that, what you see in the movie, or nothing. And normally, making a movie, I would say, okay, fuck it. We'll wait till post-production, get more money, whatever it is, and do it right. But I knew that I don't shoot that. I want to shoot the kid. It's got to be in people's hands to see somebody playing it, not this way where you see they're playing something and then a close-up. And the thing is, that would just be bullshit. And that's the reason why it was very crude. And it didn't really matter that much. You get the idea.
Yeah.
But it wasn't up to, you know, the video snuff that it should have been if I had to did it in post, you know?
And it, did your daughter do the music for that?
Yeah, oh, yeah. She didn't do the music. She did the music for the video game.
Yeah.
She went to NYU graduate school for music and film.
Oh,
and all that
shit.
Stuff. And yeah. And so she, you know, I didn't say the composer of the movie that you have to use my daughter, but like, just, I'm going to give her a crack at it and you don't have to use it. You can come up with a better thing. And you go, no, this is great. So.
Oh, that's fantastic. And then what about the doorbell, the Woolly family doorbell? Was that a composition or was that actually the doorbell that, that belonged to the house or the set or whatever?
No, that, no, we did that. I wanted that to be like a church bell.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, I put all these ideas
all in there.
Because that's not a normal ding dong.
It is not.
I wanted that to be kind of church bell. And I, we just got back from Italy and we were in Lake Como in Bellagio. It's across from Bellagio, across the lake. And these fucking church bells all day long. Driving me crazy, you know, try to keep the, and it sounds very much like that, you know, and that's what I wanted, like to sound like church bells. It's annoying.
Looking at the filming locations in Suffolk County, Long Island, New York, and tell us about shooting in that elaborate mansion where the Halloween party takes place.
Actually, it's from where I'm sitting here on Zoom, in Zoom land, it's probably 3 miles from here.
Are you kidding me?
In Yonkers. It's in Yonkers, New York, on the river, and it's the most, you know, it's one of these things where if you don't look at all the little houses around it that were built way later, this is like a castle. You don't see the Hudson River in the movie, but it's the most sensational place. I don't know, the history is over 100 years, and there was a guy who was an architect who lived there, and little by little, he was restoring the whole place. A lot of movies were shot there. I know that Julia Roberts, there was a lot of big Hollywood movies that were shot in that castle. And it's just, you don't expect it to be where it is. And the so through movie magic, in the beginning of the movie, you see the car driving in Maine. That's Maine.
Interesting. Wow.
So, and the person driving that car is me.
Oh, wow.
You don't see it, but we went second unit, just me and the DP and another guy. We went up to Maine in the fall. We shot the main movie, the body of the movie in July, went up there. So you see the ferry in the distance and you see the water so you can sell to the audience that it's an island when in fact, the main part of the movie you're watching is in Westchester and White Plains, no water. No island. There's no such thing as Belle Island.
Yeah, Belle Island. I was going to ask. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, what is it? Fly Creek. People say, I've actually seen people and they vote. That's what I always think. These people vote every 4 years. Squirm can't be a true story because the beginning it says, you know, based it's true story that this happened. Can't be. Because there's no such thing as Fly Creek, Georgia.
They nailed you.
Right. Not that there was a storm with like millions of worms. Or, no, it's because there's no, therefore, this got to be bullshit.
Right.
My only answer is like, this person's vote.
Well, one of the features on the Blu-ray that I can't wait to get, because I haven't gotten the brand new Blu-ray version yet. I just got the DVD in the screen box, is you get a studio, a location tour. Do you give the location tour on the Blu-ray?
Yeah, I went around to all the locations, but I said, I want to do like the standard. This is where we shot the castle. This is where. So what I did was I took the mask and put it on my hand like a puppet. And I took him to revisit so he could, like, I said, remember this place? And he would, you know, so I had an ongoing conversation. Yeah. And in fact, there's one point where we went in one place. I said, you remember this place? I said, bullshit, you weren't in the movie yet at the beginning. And he goes, so people responding to that, you know, great. We'll get them to watch an extra.
Right, know? Right. And then as far as like the uncut version, how much stuff was left off the previous version?
You know, the uncut, the big headline, I don't know why they, you know, the uncut, the fact is that it was never out in Blu-ray. And it looks great. You know, and that's really the point. Whether, you know, somebody put it out in Blu-ray in some small way that didn't really have any quality at all. So what Don made from Synapse is saying, let's differentiate it from that and make it clear. But there's no like missing footage. Usually you think about missing footage, and I'm not aware of anything that was. Oh, but yeah, they did. Take it back. I'm going to take that all back.
Yeah.
What happened was they cut it for television, a Blu-ray. So they did take out, right? So this is the opposite of what I just said. I just remembered that. So yeah, if you did see it in Blu-ray, you saw a TV cut thing. So yeah, I mean, it's the original movie that was DVD only in high def. Blu-ray, and it looks great. Looks really good. Color correction, everything.
Beautiful. So at this point, what has the life of Jeff Lieberman been like since Satan's Little Helper? Obviously, you did that John Waters show recently. Anything else that's been cooking?
Here's where the plug all comes in. I know out there in the radio land, they're not going to see this.
Oh, yeah. Day of the Living Me. Adventures yes. of a Cult Filmmaker from the Golden Age. A book. Incredible.
Nice. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, somebody right now who's pretty well known is doing the audio book. He tells me what chapter he's on. So the audio book is going to come out because people, that's what they do. I do it. You listen in your car like the podcast, you know. And so he's doing the book, and people are really digging the book. And it goes, what people are getting out of the book a lot is independent filmmaking, that kind of stuff. And also, if you can see on the cover, Rick Tremble's great. He did the artwork. But you can see George Burns, John Lennon, Tippi Hedren, and John Waters. All in the book, and it's all people I worked with. It's not like I met a celebrity, except for George. I double dated with George Burns, not with him. I mean, he had a girlfriend that was 32 at the time. He was 80. He did Oh God at that time. And so I knew, I did the ad campaign for Tommy. Did you know that out there? Remember Tommy?
Yeah.
Tommy, in the movie, your senses will never be the same with the cork in the mouth. And, you know, that was me. I wrote the whole thing. And so they wanted me to, same people, Rob Bestigwood, to do another thing. I didn't want to do advertising. The trade-off was that I get to blind date that this woman who was dating George Burns, that she would get a girl to be a beard, you know, like a fake girlfriend of mine. So all he knew was that another couple were coming, and people say it's the best part of the book, but it was one of the greatest No, it really was.
That is fascinating.
It was because it's one thing to meet celebrities and, you know, and they don't really, you know, everybody's the same, you know, right? So you know, in this movie and that movie, it's another thing to like be off the air and do a double date and drink and get drunk.
Oh, yeah. That's the real good stuff, man.
Wait. Too bad we're not doing a Zoom. Because I have visual aids. Right here it says, to Jeff, don't smoke it, George Burns. This is, I don't know if you see that.
It's a cigar. Cigar.
El Producto Queen. Probably cost him 15 cents. And he gave me this because I said, hey, George, you know, in the Sunshine Boys, you know, reading Variety, the guy dies, but you're going to outlive me for sure. But if you don't, when I, because I said I want, he offered me like a Dunhill Monte Cruz, like a good cigar. And I said, I can afford to buy my own fucking cigars. I want one of yours. And he goes, one of mine? You know, it's like a clothesline, you know? And he said, I've been smoking them since vaudeville because they don't go out. It's like taking a rope and setting it on fire. You didn't want to go out during the thing. So he always smoked them. So I said, I want one of yours. And then I said, if I hear, God forbid you die before I do, that's when I'm going to smoke this. And he goes like this, and his butler came over, and he took the cigar out of my pocket, and he goes like this, and the guy knew he wanted a piece of paper, and he wrote a note, wrapped the cigar in the note, and put it back in here, and put it back in my pocket. So I didn't read it. I was with the beard girl. We go out in the car. She goes, what do you write? And I looked at it under the light and said, to Jeff, don't smoke it, George Burns. And right then I'm thinking, because if I smoke it, that means he's dead. Okay. 20 years later, he dies. And I hear on the radio, all my friends that knew this because they saw the cigar in my office, what are you going to do? And I go, I'm not going to smoke it, even though I said, yeah, but I did say I'm going to do it. I don't know. And my brother, who is the big brother and things like this, and he knew I didn't want to smoke. He said, no, George knew he's going to live way longer to 100. He said he was trying to protect you because if you smoke it, you'll die.
Ah.
I'm going to go with that. I'm going with that.
I love that. I love that.
But I mean, those kind of things, Sidney Poitier story and Rod Serling. You know, I did a series with Rod Serling.
No shit.
The guy did Squirm. He didn't do Rod. So that nobody. Yeah, I did a 6-part thing called The Art of Film with Janus Films. And Rod Serling was the narrator for all of them. And I directed Rod Serling, in fact, out there in radio land or TV land or Zoom land. You can go on YouTube and put in Rod Serling, Jeff Lieberman, one of the six. Somehow I found the tape and I digitized it and uploaded it onto YouTube. And you see what's great about it. It's not just the episode. It's everything, you know, like him clearing his throat.
Oh, wow. Like all the outtakes behind the scenes stuff.
Often, yeah, saying, fuck that truck, do it again. He even says, fuck you, Jeff, which is nice. And yeah, I mean, it's really good. He does it over and over. And you're there in the room with Ron and his daughter, Ann Serling. She's on Facebook, and I told her about it. I sent it to her. And she listened to it. She was like over the moon about it. But she did say, I could tell you, my father really liked you.
Aww.
Which was, I mean, we hung out. I mean, we literally drank Rod Serling. One quick, but this is in the book. So I get Rod Serling, right? But first he's going, well, how's this thing going to be used? And he was the top credible Mazda performs. You know, he'd do a commercial and get like unbelievable money because everybody believes when he says something.
Of course, it's God. Yes, word of God.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted him. And he was very, and then finally, I answered all the questions the right way. How's it going to be used? And all. Next time, he made up his mind he's going to do this. This is Rod Serling's way of saying I'm in. They go, it's Rod Serling on three. You know, remember the phones with the buttons on it? Pick up. Hello? And he goes, a Polack, a zebra, and a rabbi walk into the bar. And he starts telling me, and I went, what? This is Rod fucking Serling telling me a Polish joke. I start laughing. He thinks I love Polish jokes. Because why am I laughing? I'm laughing because fucking Rod Serling telling me.
Yeah.
So every time I'd see him, he goes, two Polacks. He just like told me, and he thought I needed another Polish joke. When all I wanted to, I didn't want any Polish jokes, but I it was just the funniest thing in the world for him to be telling me a Polish joke and the way it sounded, because he, everything he did sounded like Rod Serling, because he's Rod Serling. And then so he says, I had to go up to Ithaca for the pilot, because that's where he was teaching in Ithaca College. He wanted to use some of the students. And so I'm going to fly up there. So now we're like frenzy wenzy. And I have a certain sense of humor. I said to him, hold it. Because he said, I'll meet you out in front of the school at a certain time. I said, how will I know you? How will I recognize you? You know, we're only talking on the phone. And he goes, excellent point. He says, I'll wear a red carnation in my left lapel. Go up there. And he's like this tall. I mean, he's really short. But I go, oh, there he is. And so I go over, and instead of going, hey, Rod, I go over looking all over for him because I don't know what he looks like, right? That's the bit. And then I see the flower. He had it, a red carnation. And I zeroed in, get really close. I go, you must be Rod Serling. That's the kind of relationship. I mean, we used to go through a revolving door, and I'd say, after you. And he'd go, no, after you. I go, no, after you. And he'd go, why, certainly. And he would go in, and I would cut in front of him. Three Stooges, Marx Brothers, everything we did. His daughter knew him, obviously, better than I did. But nobody knew this guy. He was a brilliant guy. Like, I'm not saying anything negative about what he did. He's a genius, but he's a human being and he's funny as hell. And we would just do shtick. That's how I got along with George Burns, because I was feeding him straight lines. So it's all in the book.
And if the book is half as interesting as any of these stories, man, it's going to be a fascinating read, too.
I mean, John Lennon, it's the whole great thing with John Lennon and Tippi Hedren and a lot of good shit that you wouldn't know from the horror.
Exactly. So anyone who wants to know what Jeff Lieberman's up to, why isn't he making any movies since blah, 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 blah? Yeah. Read the book. Yeah. Read the fucking book.
Oh, yes. They're living me. Yeah. I'd like to say on sale, but it's not.
Jeff, man, thank you so much for this time.
Yes,
everybody listening, get your hands on the book, wait for the audiobook, go to Jeff's website, and if you haven't been indoctrinated into the world of Satan's Little Helper, you know what to do. Screenbox and the brand new Blu-ray from Synapse with all the behind the scenes features, commentary, everything.
Website, jefflieberman.com.
There you
in
go.
New Jersey. That's Jeff Lieberman, director. Remember, we used to do that. In Wisconsin, that's jefflieberman.com. Now, I want you guys, you can get the Kindle, but then if you buy it, but here's the thing, if you buy it, I tell people, I don't care, but if you buy it on Amazon, I can't sign it. But if you buy it on my website, I can sign it because I send it out.
That's the way
most people want.
The way to do it. That's the way to do it.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm not a young man. As soon as I, boom, you read eBay, baby. Right. Look at it as an investment. It's
exactly.
An investment.
Exactly. Yeah. It's going to pay for your kids' college fund one day. Jeff, man, thank you so much. This is amazing.
Yes.
I would say this is one of my top 30 podcasts.
And that was the Boot Crew Podcast, episode 364. Special thanks to our guest, Jeff Lieberman, and special thanks to you. You can stream Satan's Little Helper exclusively on Screambox now. Production tracks for this one provided by Powerman 5000. Till next time, this is Trevin on behalf of myself, Lauren, and Leo. It's the Boot Crew saying, sweet screams.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Boot Boo Crew Podcast. Haunt the Boo Crew at TalesFromTheBooCrew.com. Tales from the Boo Crew on Facebook and Instagram. Follow us on Twitter at Tales from the Boo. The Boo Crew is Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio. The Boo Crew is produced by Lauren Shand, chopped and sliced by Trevor Shand. The Boo Crew is a TSP creation, part of the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
Bye.
A Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network, home of the Boo Crew. Horror-centric interviews, SCP archives, weekly full cast storytelling, horror queers, genre commentary from an LGBTQ perspective, and creepy for disturbing and terrifying creepypastas. Listen free wherever you stream audio and at bloodydisgusting.com/podcasts.